Good afternoon, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Larry O'Connor.
Larry.
And, thank you for that rousing. That's very affirming. And right now, my heart is about pounding outside of my chest. Hey, we need a full-size podium up here so you can't see my knees knocking. I first want to thank Billy and Lynn for inviting me down here today and for all you wonderful people being here, and for Lydia and Christy sharing. But also, I think we should take a moment and give a hand to everybody that prepared that food.
Yeah.
That was awesome. I do have a sobriety date, January 19th, 1982. I have a home group and a sponsor, and I'm blessed to sponsor men in the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am truly grateful for that today. I'm filled with emotion listening to our speakers and several comments that people have made here thus far today. A friend of mine up in Delaware says it's a great day not to take a drink. And by God, looking around here today and looking at you people, I mean, what a great, wonderful way to spend a Saturday, you know, in the spirit of recovery and fellowship. And that's not where it was happening when I got here. I can tell you that for true. I'm supposed to share in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I'm going to try and do that for you briefly. I have to say to start out with, I'm a little bit older than our first two speakers today. And my sponsor, who's 85, reminds me there's three things that happen as you get older. You know, first you forget the names and the faces and the dates. And then you forget the fact that your zipper's down. I did check mine. And then ultimately you forget that it's not down. And sorry, Billy. The older I get, the more I relate to him. It's kind of funny. God bless him. He's in a nursing home. A little bit about me. I listening to our first two speakers, I always listen rather attentively and try to listen to the similarities and the differences. Obviously, there's some major differences between myself and the first two speakers. And I didn't go chasing boys or any of that stuff. That wasn't that big deal. I didn't wear earrings or do the chanting. I was not into that business. But we did have some similarities. And I'll tell you a story that started out, and I'll do the math too for him. I'm 69 and a half years old. I got sober at age 39. And when I was a baby, if you can believe this was a baby, back in 1942, little tiny thing, and I know very few people, I think there may be one or two in this room that you might not remember it, but you were around in 1942. I got sick, very sick, twice when I was a baby. I had double pneumonia twice, and they actually thought that I was going to die. And the second time, there were no wonder drugs, antibiotics, or anything like that in those days. And I was being nursed and nurtured by three wonderful women. My mother, who was a loving woman, my godmother, who was a saintly Irish lady, and my grandmother O'Connor, who was married to a raging alcoholic. And I was crying and in distress, and to the extent that the doctor said, "You've got to stop him from crying. He's gonna hyperventilate and pass out. He's gonna get sick. He's gonna die. He's sick." And so my grandmother O'Connor said, "Why don't we try a little whiskey on his gums?" And this is a family tale that's told. It was told many times years ago. And they said they put the whiskey on my gums. They said not only did I stop crying, but I started smiling. And, with that, my grandmother O'Connor said, "Oh my God, he's got the curse." And little did they know how right she was. And for those of you that don't know it, Lydia mentioned, you know, the Irish Catholic drinking family. I'm one of those people, more like Christie's family, it skipped a generation. My grandfather was the raging alcoholic. My parents... I know that my dad had too much to drink once in his life. Once. My mother's one of those people that wasted alcohol. It drove me insane. Even before I drank, I couldn't stand watching her leave a drink. I don't know why, but it was offensive. Shouldn't order a drink and leave it. It was terrible, terrible to watch. I will tell you a couple of things that point out my alcoholism is the fact that when I was young, and again, some of the people here, I love it because some of the people here actually know what I'm talking about. When you were sick and you were a kid and you had a cold, they'd give you a hot toddy. And it was a shot of whiskey and a shot of hot water and a teaspoon of sugar, and they'd mix it up. And I had two older sisters. And sometimes kids in the family, you know, one gets it, all three get it. And we'd be up, okay, give them a hot toddy before they go to bed. And I'm the one that, you know, the girls would have it and I'd have it. And then all of a sudden I'm going, well, maybe he needs another one. And I would get two. I mean, I had a keen alcoholic mind at an early age. I didn't know what I was doing, but I did it. As time went on, when I was not late teenagers, but 16 years old, I was allowed to drink at home. And that was a big deal because I was in a 21-year-old drinking state. And you talk about a disciplined family environment. My mom was a school teacher. My dad was a police officer, specifically a detective sergeant, juvenile officer for the city. So misbehaving was not an option in our house. We were having I rode down here with some young guys, and they were talking about acting out when they were younger. I said, we didn't act out in my house. If you acted out, you got immediate attention. The right way to say it. Call parental abuse or something. But it was just absolutely amazing. I was allowed to drink at home. I would take my mother, who was literally a teetotaler, down to the package store to buy 2 6-packs, and on Friday night after a week at school, I could have a buddy over and watch TV and have some beer. Well, I always wanted to have a buddy over, and you all know why that is, because that justifies more cans. See, that guy's got it right there. More cans in the trash. Because I knew my dad was going to see the cans in the trash. But, again, more like Christy, my idea of splitting a 6-pack with you is 4 for me and 2 for you. And if it's your first experience, I got 5. And honest to God, you know, we talk about the missed signposts in life. I missed it. If that was a signpost, I missed it. And it probably was. My story is that I drank differently from the start. I did not drink like my friends ever. And I was not interested in social drinking ever. I did exactly what the big book says, and I drank for effect. And my effect that I wanted was oblivion. I am a blackout drinker. I only drank for a total of 17 years, and I drank in blackouts from 17 years. I literally have 2 decades of my life that I can tell you very little or nothing about. And I'm not proud of that. It's just my story and the way I lived it. I'm very blessed to be able to tell you I was a functioning alcoholic. I didn't drink much in high school at all. One little episode about going out to my first adult Christmas party, and for some reason on the way out of the house, I picked up a bowl of Manhattans, drank it down, then got in my car and drove home. The next thing I knew, my dad was rather upset waking me up on the couch down in the living room, which again should have been a signpost because I had never slept on the couch in the living room in my life overnight. And he wanted to know about the car, and I went out with him to inspect the car. And you talked about that right-hand turn car? Well, the car was in the driveway, but it wasn't going anywhere because the radiator had leaked out over everything, was smashed in front of it. And my dad was enough of a detective, none of the CSI stuff you see on TV today, but he said, what happened? And I said, I don't know. Get in the car. My aunt had a car there because that was the family car. The reason he discovered it was he was going to take my mom to church in the morning with the family car that obviously young lad had wrecked the night before and left in the driveway. And so he and I went back, and sure enough, it was in a snowstorm. And streets hadn't been plowed yet. We tracked my car back across town, and we came to this place, and here's this beautiful circular stuff in the middle of the street, and then all of a sudden it ends up in a telephone pole. And thank God I wasn't injured, and the young lady who I drove home very gallantly did not get injured either. She was a neighbor, and her brother insisted she ride home with me. I think it was to take care of me, but it didn't happen. But the thing about that was I didn't get in trouble. It was like a rite of passage. I mean, I got told, don't do that again. That was it. I have no restriction, no, you're not going to drink beer again. It was, don't do that again. Okay, I didn't. And so I got into college, and I want to get through this real quick if I can, because I will tell you one thing. My sponsor says no souls are saved after the hour, so the meeting will end on time. I can tell you that. In spite of the fact Billy told me I had 4 hours, but I'm not going to go. When I got into college, I didn't drink my first semester. It was a big deal in those days. back in the early 60s, better than the 70s, I was, you know, away from home, first time, you got to do well, blah, blah, blah. And I did, and I paid attention and studied, and I got through that great first semester, and gee, I passed everything, so this is going to be a breeze from now on, right? And so I can remember February 14th, Valentine's Day weekend, we went out and we drank. We were all underage drinking, didn't make any difference. The last two things I remember was an after-hours club drinking warm vodka out of a cup, which still makes me sick to this day to think of it, and then I had a pint bottle of Seagram 7. And the next piece of information is that in our dorm rooms, there's some beds on both sides, and I'm somehow playing Superman back and forth over the two beds, and I missed, and back, anybody remembers World War II, there were some military gray metal trash cans that the college had bought, and my head ended up across the top of one of those. And another momentous thing in my life here, I came to the next morning. The guys wanted to take me over to get stitched up to the infirmary, but they couldn't because I was dead drunk. And believe it or not, in college in those days, at the college I went to, drinking was forbidden. You could not drink. There was no booze on campus. And so I woke up the next day with this god-awful scar, and it was Sunday, and my folks were due to come up. So I had to call them and tell them not to come up. And, of course, the reason being that I had too much studying to do. And because I didn't want to try and explain. Now, the problem was, this doesn't mean anything to anybody else. Again, in hindsight, it means a lot to me. I wasn't necessarily a goody two-shoes growing up, but one thing I didn't do was lie to my parents. And I was 17 years old, and I told a bold-faced lie to my parents. I was 18 by then. I'd had my birthday. And that was the first time I'd ever absolutely lied to them. And I told them, I'd call and let them know. Because my folks would come up in those days, your mother would do your laundry and bring you some cookies, and your mom and dad would take you and your roommates out to dinner and that stuff. All of that stuff went on, and I missed that. I mean, if that was a signpost, I missed it. By the time I left college, I was a daily drinker. By the time I got commissioned an officer in the United States Navy, headed down to Pensacola, my claim to fame of 2,400 junior officers flying planes for the United States Navy at taxpayers' expense was the fact that I had the largest bar bill in the officers' club every single month. And my chief was very proud of me for that. And basically what I did, I supplemented my income by running the crap game in the officers' club. A lot of people don't like to hear about that, but it was the truth. The other scary part was that there's a rule about 12 hours from bottle to throttle. And that is a rule, and it's supposed to be observed. And I understand that most normal people observe it rather religiously. I can here to testify for you that I, as an active alcoholic, did not. And I can tell you of nights that I would come in at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, have a 6 o'clock hop, and I would get in the plane, strap on 100% oxygen, tell the crew chief to hold the chocks for a minute until I got enough oxygen in me so I could see down the runway and tell them, psh, pull the chocks, and off I go into the wild blue yonder. Insanity. Total insanity. Didn't realize it. Just doing what comes natural, I guess. Unfortunately, I had to stop flying, and not because of that, but because of an ear blockage problem, and I ended up with the ceremonial guard in Washington, D.C. I got out of the Navy, and I got my first job, and my boss recognized something right away about me. Of all the salesmen he had, he knew that, and he would tell all the other salesmen, the career men, the fleet salesmen, if you're going to go out at night and you're going to drink, you bring Larry with you. Because I could outdrink anybody. I would get the order signed, I wouldn't lower the price, and I was at my desk the next morning at 8 o'clock. And back in the 60s, that was the requirement. If you had a job, you had best be at your desk at 6 o'clock in the morning. I mean, at 8 o'clock in the morning. I'll also tell you that my being at my desk at 8 o'clock in the morning many times gave a whole new meaning to the term on-the-job absenteeism. Terrible. I mean, it was bad. I can remember one day, it was so bad. My boss's office was right there, and he and I had been out the night before. And I hurt so badly, the God's truth was, I could not turn my head to the left to see how he was doing. And, of course, what we're both waiting on is to determine what the appropriate time was where you could go out and get a Bloody Mary. So, you know, you had to wait till 10 or 10:30 to do that so nobody else made any comments about where you were going. So we'd go make a sales call together at 10:30 and get a little juice. The rest of my story is boring as a devil. The only reason it's painful is because I lived it. The ultimate end of it came exactly the same as what Lydia and Christy said. I hated myself. I was full of guilt, shame, and remorse. I couldn't lower my standards fast enough to keep up with my behavior. I'm a married man, 15 years married at the time, two children. When I got sober, they were 12 and 14. But starting when I was 31 years old, I wanted to go back and get a graduate degree. And I found out very quickly I couldn't work full-time, go to school full-time, and not drink. So very boldly, I quit drinking. And I quit for 3 years. Not a problem. Quit drinking for 3 years. With good news, I went back to drinking. It was our wedding anniversary. I had gotten a graduate degree, and I took my wife out to Bush's Chesapeake Inn down in Maryland. It used to be on Route 50, and I, you know, was going to celebrate. And cocktail waitress walked up before dinner and said, "Would you like a drink?" And I said, "Yes, I'll have a double VO Manhattan straight up." And to this day, I can see the look in my wife's face. And every time I say that and look at the women, you all know what was happening. I was furious. What's wrong with her? I haven't had a drink in 3 years. She knew what I didn't know. I had the two VO, double VO Manhattans before dinner. I had the bottle of wine with dinner, and I had the two Stingers after dinner. And then very gallantly, as we left the restaurant, you know, I reached into my pocket and said, "Here, you drive. I've been drinking." And she didn't find any humor in that. She realized that, of course, knew what was going on. I only drank for 4 months. After 3 years without a drink, so I'm just like Christy in that. I did my relapses before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't drink for 4 months, and then one more escapade, one more consequence of my drinking, and I ended up calling my best friend and asking him, "What do you do if you want to quit drinking and you can't stop?" And he said, "Well, you go to detox." Now, I'm going to tell you, with three college degrees, I didn't know what the meaning of the word detoxification was. So I went up to, I asked him if he'd take me, and he did, and I was so embarrassed because his wife came with him. She was sitting in the front seat of the car. I still remember it. And they were my drinking buddies. These were people I drank with a lot. And he drove me up to the hospital, and I went in and talked to the, I had a, and on the way up, you know, I'm going through, some of you have done this. You went through the mental anguish. I'm a vice president of a company. They're going to do an insurance thing. It's going to say detoxification. I may not know what that means, but everybody in the office is going to know what that means. It's all about me. Remember that. And so I get in, and the woman says, "You got to go see, you know, Dr. Christie." I go, "Fine, I'll go see Dr. Christie." I walk in, and I did what I think any good alcoholic would do. I lied. And when it got done, he said, you know, Larry said, "You just had a little bit too much this weekend. So what you need to do is find out about alcohol and alcoholism. And the county has a program I want you to go to." So I did. I went to the county alcohol awareness program. And the very first night I went to that program, they showed a movie. And the movie is the effects of alcohol on the human body. And I went home and I told my wife, "If anybody ever sees that movie, they will never drink again. And I won't." And I didn't for 18 months on willpower or won't power. Now, in that time, a couple of things happened. One was, just preceding my going up to there, the reason I called my best buddy, my wife had said when I came home after a lost weekend, "You know, Larry, you're never going to lose your family or your job because you're drinking, but you might want to look at it." That was from my wife. The doctor had said I just needed to learn how to control my drinking. And then we had a pastor. And I took this wonderful God-fearing man to lunch one day. We went to a place that was a pub. And, you know, at noontime, and the guy came over and said, "Do you want a drink?" And I said, "Oh, no, I don't drink." And my beautiful pastor looked at me and said, "Larry," he said, "there's no salvation in abstinence. The salvation is in moderation." Now, I'm here to tell you, I've got two decades of my life I don't remember, but I remember all three of those lines. And so, after 18 months, you know what happened. And it wasn't, again, it was no crisis. There was no crisis. After 18 months, I went out drinking again. And my last drink lasted 15 months long. And it's been referred to here earlier today. That last, my sobriety date's January 19th. That last Christmas holiday was not a pleasant time to be in our house. I certainly wasn't the father I was intended to be or the husband I was intended to be. I had promised myself one more time I would quit drinking. I was going to give that to the family as a Christmas gift. I was going to stop drinking. Of course, I didn't tell them. You never want to let the cat out of the bag. But I was going to, and it didn't work. One more time, it didn't work. I volunteered to take the Christmas gifts around to the neighbors. And I had a particular neighbor right next to us over here who was from New England, and he used to buy his pints at 6 o'clock in the morning. So he's probably one of us. But I took the presents over there, and of course I had bought him a fifth, and he is a kind man. And, you know, when you give somebody a fifth, the idea is you get a drink. So he had one, and then, you know, you can't have one drink, so you have two. And I don't know what time of the morning that was, but then I went over to this other neighbor's house kind of to slow down because he had a huge bar downstairs and never drank. The guy never drank at all. It was amazing. I don't know how he did it. But then the last one was my neighbor diagonally across the street who liked scotch the way I did. And, of course, I had gotten him a bottle of scotch, too. So when we went over there, I went over there. Joe was very kind, and he offered me a drink, which I did take. And then he offered me another one, which I did take. And then I don't know whether we finished it or not. That's cloudy. But I do know that I was asleep again on the couch about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. One more glorious Christmas for the family. And I'm not proud of that at all. I just was not present. I wasn't present for my family for a lot of things. I'm embarrassed about so many things with the kids that I look back. You know, when I had to ask my wife who sponsored my daughter, you know, at her confirmation, she said, "You did." I have no knowledge of it whatsoever. Who sponsored my son at First Communion? You did. And no knowledge of it whatsoever. What happened, one more night of drinking, one more consequence. I came to at 3 o'clock in the morning, standing in the bathroom of our home with my wife standing next to me. My head was split open again. My foot was split open. I'm in my underwear, and my wife is trying to convince me to go to the hospital to get stitched up. And I looked at her, and I said, "No, I want to remember what booze did to me." And I looked in the mirror, and I said what I know to this day to be the most honest prayer I've ever uttered in my life. And I said, "God, help me." And the next day, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Not as I came in 1979 as a visitor suggested by the Alcohol Awareness Program, but I came because I couldn't stand myself. I actually physically hurt inside here. I hear so much reference to the hole in the soul, and if there is one or if there was one in me, it was full of pain. I absolutely wanted to die. You know, I often tell the story, you know, you look at the things on the outside of the family. You know, there's a couple, they're married 15 years, they've got two kids in private schools, they've got two cars in the driveway, they've got an acre of ground 45 minutes from the White House, the guy's a vice president of a major corporation. Oh, by the way, he wants to commit suicide. What's wrong with this picture? And all you had to do was add alcohol into the equation. And that was my story. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I met four men that I had never known before in my life, and I didn't think I had anything in common with. I walked in at 2 o'clock on a Tuesday afternoon, and I met a guy named Fast Eddie. Now, Fast Eddie was 5 foot high and 5 foot wide. And he had never had a job in his life. So I'm looking at him thinking, I don't have anything in common with this guy at all. I've been working every day since I was 14. And then he told me he hadn't had a drink in 7 years. So I knew he was a liar. It's all about me. I had only been able to go 3 years without a drink. How's this clown going to go 7 years without a drink? So Eddie started talking to me, offered me a cup of coffee, and then he gives me half a cup of coffee. I thought he was cheap, or they couldn't afford coffee. But Eddie knew what I didn't know. I was shaking so bad I could not hold a cup of coffee, and that is no lie. I did not have the benefit of a rehab when I came in here. I came in here shaking and baking. And I shook and it really did strange things for about 90 days or more. The lights didn't come on, I will tell you this, for 9 months. But that day, Eddie started talking to me and asked me if I could come back. I said, yeah. But, you know, I don't think Eddie quite understood the caliber of person he was dealing with, so I wanted to explain that to him. So I acknowledged to Eddie, to enlighten him, that, you know, I did, in fact, have 3 college degrees. And Eddie looked at me and he said, "Larry, tell me," he said, "do you know how many degrees there are in a rectal thermometer?" I didn't laugh. But I did say, "Yes, there's 108. And he said, "That's right." And he said, "Tell me, do you know where they tell you to stick them?" And again, I didn't laugh. I was offended. And he said, "I'll tell you what, Larry," he said, "why don't you take those degrees and stick them outside the door out there?" And he said, "Come in here and find out what we're all about." He said, "I've never met anybody too dumb to get sober, but I've met a whole lot of people too smart to get sober." And he said, "And you don't need those degrees in here." Thank God for Eddie. Eddie invited me back to meeting that night. It came into a place called the Riverdale Club in Riverdale, Maryland. It's closed now, long gone. If any of you know it, it was a dirty, filthy, stinky hole in the wall. It was exactly the where this alcoholic had to go to get sober, though, I'll tell you that. And he introduced me that night to three other guys. Jim Landy, who was a locksmith from Pennsylvania. Leo Connors, who was a retired D.C. Metropolitan Police officer. And Sweet William, who was an attorney on Capitol Hill and was anything but sweet. And those four men saved my life. Those four men carried a message of hope and recovery to this alcoholic. And I can tell you this, I know the intimate details of those men's lives. They shared their details with me. And they were not saints. I guarantee that. But the message they carried to me was perfect. It was exactly what I needed to hear. And they cared about me and nurtured me when I had no idea what they were doing or what they were talking about. The very first thing they talked about was sponsorship. They said, "You got to have somebody to help you." And Fast Eddie agreed to be my first sponsor. And it was interesting the way he did it. He said, "Yeah," he said, "I'll start you out." He said, "But I don't want you to hang around the clubs here." He said, "I want you to go to the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and get involved in the meetings and service." He said, "I don't want you hanging around the club." So Eddie started me out. And he started me out on these things called the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's really what I would like to take a couple of minutes and share with you my experience on the 12 steps. Because I do believe this is a program of recovery. And my recovery has come to me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, through a gracious God, and through you people. And without those men that came here before me, I wouldn't have what I have today. Came to the first step and said, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And in the Riverdale Club in those days, up on the wall over here were the 12 steps, and up over here were the 12 traditions. And I sat back where that lady is right there, and I looked at it the first night, and I saw the first word of the first step, "we." And all of a sudden, I felt like I belonged here. I was a member of the largest Elks Lodge in the state of Maryland, the largest Knights of Columbus Council in the state, and I never felt like I belonged in either one of them. I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous as a sick and suffering, hopeless alcoholic, and I felt like I belonged, and I had never, ever been to a meeting of AA where I didn't feel like I belonged. I own my seat here. And you people understand every single word I've ever said. And more importantly, I understand everything that you've said. I've been blessed with that. And I'm pleased, you know, to be a part of that we. Being powerless over alcohol, they used to say in those days, you got to surrender to win. I mentioned I was a Navy officer. The notion of surrender, I think, is either un-American or anti-American. I'm not sure what the right word is. But I don't think we've studied it too well. And the idea of surrendering didn't appeal to me. And I said to Jim Landy, God bless him, he was about this high. And I got right in his face. And I told him, I don't like the fact I'm an alcoholic. And he looked at me very calmly and he said, Larry, you don't have to like it to accept it. You don't have to like it to accept it? Really? Oh, okay, then I can accept it. It was that simple. I mean, just, duh, you know, one brain thought right into the center of my brain. You don't have to like it. Oh, wow, that's different. And, you know, that my life had become unmanageable. I'm a visualization type guy. And they told me to look at my own record. You know, and here's my story. I got all these roles I'm playing. You know, it says we lead a double life. Hell, I led a, you know, quadruple life or something. But, you know, you're a husband, you're a father. I'm a businessman. I'm a member of the church community, the civic community, a brother, a son, all these things. And I got all these balls like a juggler up in the air with all these roles on it. And I walked around, and I learned the expression afterwards, full of fears, doubts, and insecurities, knowing that world was going to come crashing down around my shoulders at any moment. That was my story. That was my unmanageability. I used to walk through every day fear-filled, and I never could have identified that fear. I wouldn't even say the word fear with my own name in the same sentence. You know, I was in total denial over what the truth was in my life. I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I'm one of the guys here that I did. I came here physically. I came to mentally, and I came to believe. And what I came to believe was very simply what those four men told me. They started out the very first night. Eddie sat next to me. And I said, I was in a very mocus condition. And Eddie, in a booming voice, said, one day at a time we don't take a drink of alcohol. One day at a time we get to a meeting. And one day at a time we pray to the God of our understanding. And our lives will get better. And then, as if I didn't hear him, he said it exactly the same way. One day at a time we don't take a drink of alcohol. One day at a time we get to a meeting. One day at a time we pray to the God of our understanding and our lives will get better. And then he turned it around to me, you know. Those four men echoed that every single day. One of those four guys said that same thing. So I came to believe what they were saying. And then pretty soon, there were tables, and not chairs like this, but there were tables. Pretty soon I realized, as we're going to different meetings every night of the week, by the way, all of these people sitting around these tables are saying the same thing. We don't take a drink of alcohol. We get to a meeting, we pray one day at a time, and our life will get better. They kept repeating it. So I believed what the four guys said. Then I started believing what the people around the meeting table said. And I started to believe what the people in Alcoholics Anonymous said. And then, very quickly and very suddenly, that morphed into the fact that I believed in the God of my family, my youth, my childhood, and my religion. And I'm here to tell you today that my understanding of God today is totally different than it was in 1982 when I came to this fellowship. Completely different. I didn't understand an iota of spirituality at that point. But I did have an idea of God because I had had a loving God in my life, and I didn't drink alcohol for 3 years. I had a loving God in my life, and I didn't drink alcohol for 18 months. I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a loving God in my life, and you people in 12 steps, and I've not had a drink since I got here. That tells me that God, as I understand God today, wills my sobriety one day at a time, but only in and through the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I absolutely have to be here with you people on a daily basis. There is no other alternative for me. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. As a businessman, I make 1,000 decisions a week. These decisions are easy for me. I wanted to know, what is it? What's the decision I make? Turn my will and my life. What's my will and my life? My thoughts and my actions. Over to the care of God. I don't just abrogate my life to God and then walk away and say, hey, God, it's yours. You got it. I'm out of here. Can't do that. You know? I call this, by the way, reality therapy. Living in the real world. With all of our, you know, whether they're spouses, children, teachers, parents, bosses, whatever, this is reality therapy. This is where we got to do it. I turned my will and my life over to the care of God. My sponsor gave me a great gift. By that time, I had my permanent sponsor, who's been my sponsor ever since. And he had me do the third step and say the third step prayer together with him on our knees, holding hands. It was an eerie experience for me, a little bit unusual. But he asked me what that prayer meant to me, and I went through it. And then he told me that I could restart a new day, any day I wanted to, by simply saying that third step prayer and reaffirming my decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. And I've done that every day since I've been to Alcoholics Anonymous. This morning in the hotel, I got on my knees when I got out of bed and said my prayers. That's what I was taught to do here by you people. I will mention something about that. When I came here and they suggested that I get on my knees and say my prayers, I hadn't been on my knees outside of a church since second grade, I guess it was. And so I obviously couldn't get on my knees in front of my wife and have her see me praying at home. So I would say, you know, now it's fine. You got to understand the turn here. It's fine for me to come home at 3 o'clock in the morning, drunk out of my mind, to flop on top of the bed and announce the world's greatest lover has just arrived on the scene. That's cool. God forbid she see me get down on my knees and say my prayers, you know. So, mocha's condition. It took me about 3 months to get over that. I will tell you, you know, in the third step prayer it says, relieve me of the bondage of self. I used to stop when I said that prayer. And I'm telling you, I was in a mocha's condition. I used to stop when I got, relieve me of the bondage of self. And then for God's benefit, I would stop and tell God the 5 things that I needed to be relieved of that day. And I didn't realize for, again, 2 to 3 months that I was telling God every day exactly what to do. Didn't dawn on me at all. But thank God in time it did. And the fourth step, you know, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I'm one of these guys, you know, we talked about discipline and regimes at home. I wanted to be a perfectionist, so not that anybody else in AA would ever do this. But I got out my big book and read the four step. I got out the 12 and 12 and read the four step. I got out the little red book we used to use in those days, which is a great book on the steps, and went through that. And then I got the Hazelden Guide number 1 and the Hazelden Guide number 2 and Phil Jones' 55 questions about the four step and Tom Smith's 542 questions about the four step and got totally confused. And at that point, Jim Landy said, Larry, when you get done with all that stuff and all your reading, come on back and I'll tell you how to do a four step. So I did. And I do want to quickly share this story. I did my fifth step. I was on a 12-step AA, well, not AA, but 12-step retreat, a Men of Serenity retreat. And I was going to share my fifth step. And so we went up to room after dinner and already arranged I was going to share my fifth step. And I did. And I had done as complete and thorough a job as I could possibly do. And I opened my heart and everything inside of me to another man. And quite frankly, we cried a little bit at some times. And then he said, okay, this is good. Now go back to your room. And as the book tells us, take an hour and reflect upon the archway you've built into your new pathway of freedom. And I did that and felt pretty good about it. That had been, to this day, it's the most thorough inventory I've ever done in my life. And I shared all the things, the resentments, the fears, the sex situations, the other, and all the secrets that I ever had conjured up that I was going to take to the grave with me. And the next morning we had prayers on this retreat at 5 of 8 before we went into breakfast. And I went in the chapel and I'm looking around the chapel and I don't see him. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what I shared with him last night was so bad that he has left this retreat. And everybody here knows that I shared my fifth step with him last night. And if he went out last night, he probably drank too. And I, 5 minutes worth of prayer was a lifetime. I was sitting there, honest to God, soaked in sweat, beet red, didn't know what I was going to do. The prayers are over. We got to go into breakfast. And I'm thinking, I cannot go in and face these people. They all know the truth of what happened because it is all about me. And I'm going through the doorway, and all of a sudden this arm comes over my shoulder from the back, and this voice says, do you feel as good about last night as I do? And I turned, and it was him. The reason I didn't see him, he was sitting directly behind me in the chapel. My vantage point is not always correct. I then went on with the 6th and 7th step with my sponsor, and I'm going to tell you exactly how we did it, because everybody here who has read the big book knows and understands that after all, Bill Wilson, in his wisdom when he wrote the big book, the 6th and 7th step is only 1 inch of type apiece, 4 or 5 sentences. Let's face it, the 7th step is only the 7th step prayer. How important can that be? I read them in the 12 and 12. I talked to my sponsor, and I moved on to the 8th step. That was the first time I did the 6th and 7th step. It was a brief encounter, and it was probably the best I was capable of doing at that time. We were talking about that yesterday, and I firmly believe that the first time most of us meet the 6th and 7th step, we haven't got a clue of what they mean. I will tell you this, in pretty good hindsight right now, I have spent several visits directly with the 6th and 7th step, motivated by great pain in my recovery, as I have gone back and looked again of being entirely ready to have God remove my defects of character and humbly asking him to do the same. Being entirely ready. Not just my alcoholism, which God has given me a miraculous recovery to. Not just alcoholism. My family, my work, my community, every aspect of it. The other drivers on the highway, which I still have a problem with. I drive every day for a living. It's kind of bad to be out there sometimes. And I have trouble, expressing myself sometimes on that. But the truth is, I have been driven back to the 6th and 7th step in great pain in this fellowship. I have character defects that absolutely drove me insane for years. And, it took me a while. I engaged, and I was on another retreat, and this retreat leader said to me, he said, well, Larry, he said, did it ever occur to you that God doesn't think that's a character defect for you? Huh? No, of course not. You know, and then I started thinking about it. And then he said, why don't you reread the seven-step prayer? You know, my creator, I'm not willing to have all of me good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character, which stands in the way of my usefulness. If it doesn't stand in the way of my usefulness, I still got it. And I still got it. So I had to come. I had said that prayer. I said a third-step prayer and a seven-step prayer every single day of my sobriety. And this is no lie. For 18 years, I missed that part of it, where it says, which stands in the way of your usefulness. I missed it, totally. I'm going to have some character defects. I dare say they might give you a little bit of humility. Now, St. Larry is not standing up here right now, I can assure you that. But then I made my eight-step list, you know, and I learned a lesson in making the eight-step list, because I made a list of persons I had harmed, and then I went out to make amends to one particular one that I thought was very important to go make, which I obviously did not talk to my sponsor about ahead of time, and which I went out and made a bad situation worse, and I can let you all fill in the blanks any way you want to fill them in. And I went running back to my sponsor. Oh, I did the man I was, will drink again. He said, okay, knock it off. I said, you're not the man you were. Start with that. And he said, there's a deal with the eighth step. You make your list and you become willing. That's the eighth step. And before you do the ninth step, you talk to your sponsor. And you check your motive. And you check your motive with your sponsor. So I made the rest of my amends at his direction. Much better results. I got to the 10th step. Continued to take personal inventory when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I was not on the 10th step the first time. I was with my son out in the shed, and I think he was 12 years old at the time. And we were doing something about a shaft on a pulley and a sleeve, and I was trying to separate them, and I had a sledgehammer in my hands, and I asked him to hold it. And I swung the sledgehammer, and he let go of it, and I went, lay! And I looked down, and here's this 12-year-old kid, absolutely petrified of his father. Totally petrified. And when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And when we were wrong, promptly admitted it, started reeling in my head. And I went over to him, and I held him, and I apologized. And I told him I was wrong. And I said, let's try and talk our way through this. And I'm here to tell you, the other two times that I had to do that step was actually with my son as well. The last time he was about 21. And I'm not a mechanically inclined person. So anything more than a two-position on-off switch is beyond my capabilities. So we had this thing down. We have a picture in a picture on a TV. I've never seen it in 30 years because I don't know how to put the picture in the picture. So, but we had a thing with Comcast in those days, and you had to switch from A to B, and that was beyond my level of capability too. And I wanted to watch something, so it came into my endearing voice on a Saturday night. You know, Larry, get down here, fix the television. He comes running down and says, "What do you need, Dad?" I said, "I'm on a B. It's got to be on B." So he goes over, clicks at the B, and. Is that what you want? Yeah. So he goes upstairs. And I watched the program that I wanted to watch before my home group meeting that night. And naturally, I went to my home group meeting that night, and I don't need to tell you what the topic was, because the topic was the 10th step. And I'm sitting at the... I'm going to go home and apologize to that kid again because of what I did before I got here, and I'm listening to these people talking about the 10th step. So I went home, and I said, Larry, I said, I've got to apologize to you for hollering and having you come downstairs and fix it. He said, Dad, you don't need to apologize to me. I know you didn't mean anything by it. I said, no, Larry, you're wrong. I have to apologize because I was wrong, and I need to acknowledge that. And that's a gift that you people have given me. The 11th step is one of my favorite steps, if there are favorite steps. But I do sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him. The reason I like the 11th step is because we're going to talk about God and we're going to talk about prayer. And my personal experience, I only speak for myself. I don't know how anybody could stay sober for a long period of time without God and prayer. The basis of my program is on prayer and the relationship that I have with God today. And I do a lot of neat things with it. I think they're neat things. I can tell you stories. I've got to watch my time, but I can tell you stories of using prayer. I do it to this day. Christy went in the room. I went and took a little walk outside before we started here today, and I just asked God to say what I got to say. Because I mentioned I drive in my job, and I drive and I invite God to sit next to me Now, it's my personal belief that God's not over there, God's in me. And as was said, the God in me speaks to the God within you. But I do, I acknowledge it because I want the conscious contact. On the front of my car, there's a sticker with the XI for 11 on it that says conscious contact in my front windshield. The reason it's there is because that's where I look when I'm going to say or do something that I shouldn't do to particular drivers on the highway. And I want to be reminded that in saying a certain expletive, I can say God bless them in their ignorance or stupidity or whatever. But that's what it's there for. But I've had things happen with God that you just wouldn't believe. I'm telling you, you just would not believe. God is powerful in my life. I have to share this. A couple of years ago, I was diagnosed with cancer, and it wasn't good, and it needed quick surgery and everything. And the two things I'm going to share with you about it. One was we were up at Johns Hopkins, and I was going to get wheeled into surgery, and I said goodbye to my wife and kids standing there, and. One of the things that's been important for me is the presence of God. And I was laying on the gurney, and I invited God to be with me, and I told God, I said, I need you real close right now. And I actually scooted over on the gurney to the left side, and I kid you not, I could feel the presence of God next to me as I got wheeled into the operating room. And when I came to, they told me some things, and then I had a 30-day recovery period, and I had to have a blood test to know about chemotherapy and radiation and all the rest of that stuff. And that was pretty much what it was going to be. And I had my blood test done, and I had to wait a few days for the results. And I do a lot of spiritual reading, and I read the things about, you know, the fact that I'm a child of God, I'm a child of a loving God, and that God wants nothing but the best for me. And I'm entitled to the kingdom of heaven, whether it be in the kingdom of heaven somewhere or right here. I'm entitled to the kingdom of heaven. The best that God has to offer, I'm entitled to. And I will tell you this. That after I had that blood test taken, I talked to God, and I asked God. I said, God, I want my miracle, and I want it now. And I wasn't kidding about it. The doctor called me the next day to congratulate me on being cancer-free, and I've had 5 good blood tests since then, and I've had no chemotherapy and no radiation, and I consider that I got my miracle. Thank you. But that's the powerful grace of God in my life. You know, God restored me through the grace of you people in 12 steps. And God has stayed with me through good times and bad times. You know, it's not all hearts and flowers and roses and sunny days. We all know that. I've been unemployed 5 times in sobriety. I'd never been unemployed in my life until I was 43 years old. But I've learned how to be pretty good in not working. It works pretty nicely. I'm 70 now, or coming on 70, and I still work. So, you know, you got to do what you got to do, but I'm very pleased to be able to do that. I came to the 12th step, you know, of having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all my affairs. Having had a spiritual awakening, my spiritual awakening was not like Bill Wilson's. I've had no white light experience. I've had no burning bush. And frankly, I'm pretty glad that I didn't, because I'm not sure how I could have handled it. But what I have had is of the educational variety. And by that, I can only tell you again, from my own personal life experiences, the man that I brought to you people in 1982, January 19th, a hopeless, helpless alcoholic, full of self-centeredness, driven by 100 forms of self-centered fear, consumed by self, arrogant, egotistical. We can fill in a couple of other words, but I promised Billy I wouldn't say them. But I was not described as a nice guy when I got here, I can assure you of that. And today, instead of a self-centered man, I try to lead a God-centered life. And that's been my spiritual awakening, going from self-centeredness to God-centeredness, the best I can. I fail daily. But when I ask God for grace, I've got to take the actions as if He's already given me that grace. When I ask God to remove me of a compulsion to gamble, I can't go up to the window at the racetrack with a $20 bill and say, God, don't let me give this to that ticket taker there. Don't let me give him this $20 bill. My job is don't go to the racetrack, dummy. Yeah. There's other things. You all know what they are. I mean, we just have to take the actions that support the prayers that we ask God to give us help and grace on. Carry this message. What's the message? You got a problem with alcohol? We got a solution. That's my message. You have a spiritual malady, and we have a spiritual solution. This is a God-centered program. I make no apology for saying that. And that's exactly what our book says. We don't make any apology for talking about God at all. And practice these principles in all my affairs. That's the theme of this day today. Practice these principles in all my affairs. I once told my sponsor something I was doing. He said, Larry, if you can't practice these principles in all your affairs, maybe you need to change your affairs. And he was right. So I had to change my affairs. I want to tell you just a couple of little things that have happened to me in my life in recovery. Because it's been a blessing. And I have to be honest with you and say, I couldn't right now, this moment, be happier to be any place else in the world than I am right now here with you people. Because this is my life today. When I was sober, my fourth Christmas, remember I had been 3 years without a drink before I got here. My fourth Christmas, we have a little ritual in our house where the kids get their stuff and we have coffee and my wife makes banana bread and whatnot. And I was out in the kitchen to get a cup of coffee. My wife came up behind me and hugged me and she said, Larry, I want you to know one thing. She said, the best present is not underneath the Christmas tree. That was my fourth Christmas sober. I will tell you that my daughter, and it was about later on the next year, went into college. And she came home for Christmas and announced she was going out for the evening. And I asked what I call the daddy questions. You know, where are you going? Who are you going to be with? What time are you coming home? Every daddy asks that. My daughter turned around and unloaded on me like something you've never heard in your life. This is a girl that I love with all my heart and soul, and I really do. We have a wonderful relationship today. But that day and that time, it was the wrong question, and she told me the truth of my alcoholism in her life, and it was not nice to listen to. When she asked me why, I used to ask her, why don't you bring your friends home after school? And she said, because she didn't know what condition her father would be in. She wouldn't invite him over for dinner because she didn't know whether her father would have his face down in his food again. And I can stand here this afternoon and tell you people, God is my judge, that on a stack of Bibles that high, I never was like that in my home. And that would be a lie. Because the truth of my alcoholism, my wife knows, my son knows, and my daughter knows. And I don't know. I was a blackout drinker. And I don't remember any bit of that at all. But I will tell you that that same girl, the year she graduated from college, came up to New Hampshire, where I was living at the time. And we walked along the seacoast together, arm in arm. And she told me how pleased she was to be graduated from college and that she knew that if I were not a sober man, she would not have gone to the college she went to. And I will tell you, when it came to her wedding day and we went to walk down the aisle, we were standing in the back of the church, she looked at me and she said, you know something, Daddy? The best part of the day is not the fact that I'm on your arm. The best part of the day is the fact that you're a sober man. And I cried all the way down the aisle. I had a chance with my son, and Christy mentioned this with her children. When my son was in college, I was up in New Hampshire running a business up there, and he would come up and spend his breaks, his spring breaks, up skiing with me. And I can tell you, days just raging down the mountains with he and I by ourselves and tears just streaming out of my eyes, thanking God that I was, in fact, the father that I knew I was supposed to have been and I knew I could have been. And I knew, and I was the man I was because you people allowed me to be that father. And just enjoyed it beyond belief. My son had his first child. As he and his wife came up from the delivery room, and they came in the room and he's got the baby in his arms, he walked over and presented that child to me, and my first grandson. And he stood next to me and he looked at people and he said, now take a picture of this. That never would have happened. Never would have happened. My wife and I have celebrated 45 years of marriage this past December. And that is much to her credit, obviously. I mean, I stand here today, and I'm the man I am because of the woman that has been with me all these years. There's no doubt about that at all, and there's no denying that. I have the best wife that any man could ever ask for or hope for, beyond anything I deserve. But she has stood by me all these years, and she's put up with my nonsense. And she's allowed me to, you know, live my life and live my passion in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's ironic. I have never had anyone, my wife or either one of my kids, ever suggest, Dad, we don't think you should go to a meeting tonight. I never said that. I am about running out of time. I just want to close with the following. I like to close with it any time I'm given an opportunity to share. And I will tell you people that, being here today really it just means the world to me. And again, Billy, thank you. Lynn, thank you. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. The program works best if you don't take a drink of alcohol one day at a time. If you don't have a sponsor, get one. If you don't think you need a sponsor, get one. If you've got a sponsor, use them. Back to you. Thank you.